This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
You know, I could dunk a basketball in eighth grade. I was playing running backs, and I was scoring touchdowns in eighth grade. I was more of an offensive player than I was a defensive player in junior high. And I was had more success, I would say, as an offense because I scored more touchdowns and touched the ball and did a lot more things on that side of the ball than I did on defense. As you get older and you play more, my freshman, sophomore year, the game starts slowing down a little bit and you're like, whoa, man, I think I could be very good at maybe varsity, you know, as a sophomore and then be all district, et cetera. You have to set goals, right, as you go. And I never thought, never, ever, in my wildest dream, I would think that I would ever play college football.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
Hey, Dad, how are you?
I'm doing good, thank you.
What does it mean to be Vietnamese to you nowadays?
It really defines my route to where I came from. I think I'm a proud Vietnamese American. I think being Vietnamese descent and American, I think really define who I am. I have learned so much through my 40 plus years of on this earth, and I wouldn't be prouder to say that I'm Vietnamese American just because of what I've learned, work ethic, faith.
Was it always like that for you?
You know, I think when you get older, you just learn and you just go and you accept certain things and I'm not the perfect saint. There's things that I do that I wish I didn't do or that experience. But it's part of, your life. You go through this good and bad. But I'm just, for my parents to do what they did to, if you didn't know the story, they left in 1975. Mom was 5 months pregnant with myself, and I have five other siblings. Oldest was 12, all the way down to my mom being pregnant, and my brother was being 1 year old, leaving Vietnam to come to America for an opportunity. So, I don't know. I would have that courage at 30 years old for what my dad did. If I think back to I have my family and we have to do the same thing. I guess I would have to do that, but you're talking about how much courage it took for him and my mom to make that decision.
Where did they land when they got here?
So we got here, we got into Camp Pendleton, and then we flew into Fort Chaffee, Arkansas. That's where I was born, at a refugee camp there in Arkansas.
Yeah, and then you guys made your way down to Texas?
Yeah, so obviously in Vietnam, we were in the shrimping business, the fishing industry. When we dispersed from Fort Chaffee, Arkansas, we had some family went to all parts of the country. Some went to New Orleans, other went to California, some went to East Coast. Some of our family were down in Rockport, which we finally settled in Rockport. It's a small fishing industry or town. And some of our relatives were down there. So my mom's family were down there. So we went down there and we settled down there. Ironically, we live in that small town of Vietnam called Binh Dinh, right? And translation of Binh Dinh is Port of Rock. And we settled in a small town of Rockport. Wow. For the last 40 plus years. So it's kind of ironic how God sent us to certain places. And it was pretty ironic.
And when the family arrived at Rockport, they started getting back into the shrimping business right away?
Well, that's all we knew. And as we had to build, really work together, we didn't have much. We live in government housing. Mom was working at restaurants. Her aunt, all my ladies, all the ladies were working at the restaurants, and all the guys were fishermen. So that's all they know or knew what to do or how to do. So they got together, and all the money that they saved, they bought the boat together. And what they did was that they distributed the profits to each family. So I think it was like four or five family per boat. And it's not a big boat, but they went out and they worked 7 days a week and try to put food on the table and put clothes on our back. And then eventually, as years goes on, they were able to save some more and move out of where we were and gave the kids a little bit of more opportunities.
Right. What was it like for you growing up? Do you remember, you know, your first memories of coming up in Rockport?
I remember what my mom said was, I remember elementary, I guess I was really kindergarten. And what my mom said before I went to school, she said, whatever you do, just make sure you stay close to your brothers and your sisters and your relatives. Because we didn't know there was a lot of tension going on during that time. And as a kid, you didn't know much. You know what I mean? I didn't know. I was like, man, I just want to go play recess and run around and jump on a monkey bar or get on the swing, whatever it is. And I think that's what I remember. And for me to experience that at a young age, I think you know, it's hard to get trust, to earn trust. And I think, you know, we weren't really felt accepted during that time. And that was in the 75, 77, so 79 when I went to school. So really, during that time was hard. It was very, very hard for our family. And I bet you without faith, there was every night question mark and doubts of did we make the right decision to come over to America.
And in high school, were you a big kid already?
You know, I was, I got big one summer. I guess what's up, like seventh grade, eighth grade. I was bigger than a lot of my friends. I was 5'9" and a half, probably 180 pounds.
Oh, wow.
My mom, as we did the shrimping business, obviously my mom got into the restaurant business when she was working but multiple jobs at restaurants, and she decided, shoot, I'm just gonna have my own restaurant. So they saved up a lot of money and built the restaurant, I guess, when I was in sixth grade, for a few years. And we opened up a restaurant. It was a Chinese buffet, and you know, it was a lot of traffic. But as you know, buffet, there's not much margin of profits. Right. So, my mom always said, when I got seventh and eighth grade, and I was, you know, bigger than all my Asian friends, my mom would say, man, you ate me out of business. So we got out of the restaurant business for a little bit, especially the buffet. She knew the buffet wasn't a good idea. Yeah, we had traffic, but the profit margin was so small. So so we decided to leave that for a little bit. But I was such a bigger than my friends, and I thought I was going to be the next Shaquille O'Neal, man. You know, and hanging out with my boys, because I was so much bigger than all my Asian friends, and I was playing basketball, and I liked basketball, and I was decent at it. But I thought I was going to tower over those guys and just keep growing. But unfortunately, I stopped about 5'11" and some change. So I would have moved about another inch or so after that.
Yeah, but you said 180 in eighth grade.
I was a big boy. Yeah.
Yeah, that's big. Yeah.
Yeah, I played linebacker and I played fullback, and I was a good sized kid. I was 230 pounds in college. In high school, you know, before I even went to college, I played at 235 in high school. So I played much bigger, and then I had to lose weight when I got to A&M to be able to get some speed and quickness and all that, and have muscles instead of just a lot of baby fat.
Yeah, so at seventh grade, you're 180, 190. Did you feel like athletically you were heads above the other kids already?
You know, I could dunk a basketball in eighth grade. You know, I played, yeah, I guess I was much bigger. I really was just a more, I don't know, God gave me the ability. I was quick. I was not the fastest guy out there, but I was playing running backs, and I was scoring touchdowns. In eighth grade, I was more of an offensive player than I was a defense player in junior high. I was more, had more success, I would say, as an offense, because I scored more touchdowns and tennis, touched the ball and did a lot more things on that side of the ball than I did on defense. But yeah, it came naturally. I think it just came as he went on. He was just a football player. He didn't know how good you were going to be because he didn't have any other Asian American to look up to. You know, I think it was Michael Chang was the only one during that time, you know, in the tennis. And I was like, oh, wow. And then you start watching sports, and now he's talking about watching football. And as you get older and you get play more, my freshman, sophomore year, the game starts slowing down a little bit. And you're like, whoa, man, I think I could be very good at maybe varsity, you know, as a sophomore, and then be all district, et cetera. You have to set goals, right, as you go. And I never thought, never, ever, in my wildest dream, I would think that I would ever play college football.
Really?
So Division One football, yeah.
Yeah, you didn't even think about that in high school.
I don't know. No. We don't see what's crazy, Kenneth, was that, you know, nowadays we have Facebook, we have Instagram, we have all these social media, we have all these recruiting websites. And we didn't have all that back then, man. So I was a late bloomer. I think everybody had the recruiting visit, everybody did all that stuff, and I didn't get recruited till December 1st. Man, I get a knock on the door first thing in the morning, 8 o'clock in the morning, get a knock on the door. We open the doors, the head coach of the University of Michigan. Flew 3,000 miles away from Michigan, Ann Arbor, to come and visit me because we sent out some tape. My high school coach made some highlight tape and he sent it off, and they were interested. So they came down, and she caught me off guard too, because we didn't have phone calls, because mom was doing the rosary every night. But when the phone rings, boy, she's hanging it up. She ain't picking that thing up. You know what I mean? She's like, I don't know how many head coaches or coaches that called our house during the recruiting process, my mom just hung up when she's in the middle of her rosary. So I was like, whoa, what did we do here? Head coach is here, the recruiting coordinator, Cam Cameron was there. And then I had to call my cousin. I said, hey, my cousin was a pioneer of high school football for Vietnamese American. You know, his name is Han No. He played a three technique. He was a little bit bigger, but he played. He's really opened up the door for all of us that were playing during that time. And so I called him over. I go, hey, you busy? He said, no. I said, hey, I need you to come over. Gary Moeller. He said, who? I said, Gary Moeller from University of Michigan. He said, no way. So he runs over. Because, you know, in a small town of Rockport, man, everybody lives about 5 minutes away from each other. So he comes over and he's like, oh, he was starstruck. You know, he's like, damn, this is a guy I watch on TV, you know what I mean, with the University of Michigan on Saturday. So he sat, we talked, and he's translating to mom and dad because they don't know what's going on. And they, you know, they're saying, oh, we want him to come up to visit to Michigan. We'll give him a scholarship, pay for his school. My mom's like, man, what the heck? No way. I put your sisters through school and to college. I know how expensive that is. And nobody's going to pay for your education. And you can play football. And on top of that, I was playing football. Like, what the hell, football? You know what I mean? They went to two games my whole high school career, my junior year, my senior year, both were parents' night. They don't understand the game. And that was kind of funny. But about 5 days, or I guess 10 days later, or 9 days later, was the December 10th, I flew out to Michigan for my first recruiting trip. First time I flew on a plane. First time I saw snow. First time I ate lobster. And I was like, oh, shoot, this is unreal. Treating you like royalty. I was there with Charles Woodson, the late Daryl Russell, Sean Springs. Man, you're like, all this recruiting class, the same class that we were in, all these guys were who's who around the country. I didn't know because I didn't know. I was from a small town, didn't have much history of the game of football. Didn't know what recruiting was like, too. So I go to the game, watch the Fab Five. Chris Webber just left, really Fab Five minus Chris Webber, played Duke. Front row seats, man, watching the game. I was like, wow, this guy, I'm going to go blue. I'm amazing. You know, I'm coming back in the fall. I'm going to play for Michigan. So I'll fly back home. I'm cloud nine. Talk to my high school coach. He's so asked about the trip and how did it go. I was like, man, it was unbelievable. I'm going to be going to Michigan. He goes, whoa. Slow down. Hold your horses, son. He goes, you got 4 more official visits that's paid for. Pick 4 more schools and go. I know it's going to be hard because we play Friday night football. They're going to fly you out after the game. So I decided to go down to UCLA. You know, I flew out to UCLA. Terry Donahue, the late Terry Donahue, was the head coach during that time. Mike Nguyen, who was African-American, Vietnamese, and half African-American and half Vietnamese, he was playing receiver for UCLA during that time for Jay with JJ Stokes. They were going to the bowl game, the Rose Bowl. So we flew out there. I understand this is late now. Sign mm-hmm. date is the first week of February. So this is all end of the week before Christmas, really, that I'm flying out to UCLA, and Mike was my host. We had a good time. And Mike was funny because Mike's like, hey, you know, Jackie Robinson started this African-American deal. You and I come here, we start the Asian-American. So he goes, man, 30% of the student enrollment are Asian. You fit right in. And so he's trying to sell me all this stuff, but you know, it goes back to the same thing. I flew in a plane, I saw sunshines and palm trees, and I ate lobster. I was like, man, what's the common denominator here? What's going on? So I came back home, and it was Christmas, and the following week was January, a few days after January, I flew out to Austin. So University of Texas, my next visit. So I went there, and we had a good time. All of who's who of Texas was in at this recruiting trip, and ate way too much Earl Campbell sausages. So I think I got sick from there, but then I was supposed to go to Notre Dame. Obviously mom was Catholic. We were thinking about Notre Dame was in fourth school. And then we decided, I'm gonna go to A&M instead. So I visited A&M. And then went to A&M, and I felt like A&M was somewhere that
okay. So these are all big schools you went to. Why A&M?
Wow. So I went to A&M, and A&M's known for linebacker U. You know, all those coaches, they are car salesmen. Man, they know what to say. They know what button to touch. You know what I mean, to press. So for me, you know, you're 17 years old, man. It's like, oh, you come here, you'll be the first Vietnamese American ever to play the linebacker U of the South, which is linebacker U of the North is Penn State. So they were selling me all this stuff. You're only three hours away from home. If things go bad or you want to go home, you miss your mom's home cooking, you can come home. You just get in the car and go home. But you go to Michigan, you're 3,000 miles away. Stranded out there. There's no such thing as jumping in a car and just go home. So they were selling me all this stuff. And where are you going to live when you graduate from Michigan? You're not going to live in Michigan. Anyway, it's too cold up there. So you live in Texas. Guess what? Networking. You're going to meet other Aggies and you have a better job. And at Texas A&M, after you graduate, people don't, you know what they call you after you graduate? They call you boss. You know what I mean? So they did all this stuff to sell me, which, you know, I jumped right in it too. You know, I was believing it, I was bleeding it, and I think back now at 17 years old, you're overwhelmed. You know what I mean? You're tired, you're flying out, just got Christmas, New Year's, and now you're flying out again. So you were tired going through the process. And now, hey, time is getting close. Signing day is around the corner. You know what I mean? A week or 2 weeks from now, signing day, you gotta make a decision. And I think that was the first time that I ever asked God to help me. I was like, man, I was 17. I was overwhelmed. I had so much stuff going on. I was like, I don't know where to go. All these schools are so good. And I said, just help me. And I'm going to go to sleep. And I was tired. During that time, I was playing basketball, too. So, you know, maybe we're going through basketball, which kind of helped not think about it. But the process. And I remember going to sleep and asking God. I said, hey, God, just give me an answer. Just give me whatever word comes out of my mouth first. That's where I'm going to school. And when I woke up that morning, it was like gigging Maggie's. And Aggie Land was where I was going to be. And I called the coaches, all the coaches the next that day. And with my high school coach. And we announced that, hey, we were going to go to A&M instead. So, but, you know, going to A&M, it was a great, great process of recruiting. It was fun. I think a lot of our family and friends got to meet some of those coaches. And they come and visit afterwards, too. So think about when I went to recruiting visit, I came back. And, yeah, I was going to UCLA or whatever I needed to go, or Texas or A&M. Excuse me. During that time, Michigan can still come and visit you. So they still come to the house. Mom has a feast. She cooked and hung out. And we got, you know, you just got to know people. And every time he was Cam Cameron and Jim Herman both were, and Jim was the linebacker coach during that time. But you know, they were at the house quite a bit. We got to know him, and it was good. You know, it was a great experience. And
looking back, do you ever wonder what life would have been had you gone to UCLA or Michigan or Notre Dame?
Well, I don't think I think I would have thrown up the red flag because a lot of people don't know the story of A&M either. So when I got to A&M, I show up, obviously no Facebook, no Instagram, no recruiting website. So I show up and there's five linebackers not signed. And I was like, I'm sitting there in this auditorium. I was like, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I was like, A&M's known for a famous 3-4 defense, 3 defensive linemen, 4 linebackers. One of the linebackers can't play. He's not going to play. It was me. I had a red shirt. I wasn't, remember, I was 230 pounds. I wasn't fast enough. I had a lot of baby fat. So, shoot, man, yeah, you were the best thing since sliced bread. And now you show up and everybody out of 105 players that all were all district, all state, all American, et cetera, at their schools, respective schools. So I was going to transfer. I was going to leave A&M. I was going to quit football. I was like, golly, I'm the only Asian. I'm never going to play at A&M. I'm never going to be too good. These guys are too good. So that could easily happen to me at Michigan and UCLA. I would just throw the flag and, you know what I mean? And wouldn't play anymore. Wouldn't play football. Where I came back home to Rockport and I talked to my high school coach and he told me, he goes, Dad, athletically, your ability is going to end one day. If it's 18 years old, or if it's 25, or it's 40, one day it's going to decline. So I need you to go back to A&M, reevaluate your priorities. Football should be second. Academic should be first. You know, 17, 18-year-old kid, man, you don't want to hear that. But guess what? I had to go back. I was like, man, he's right. But at that drive, the three-hour drive back to College Station, as mad as I was, as frustrated as I was, as hard as it was, you know, I thought about, man, hey, I just want to give myself an opportunity. Not many people in the position that I am in. There's only 25 of these guys that sign. I'm one of them. And every year, I think about 25 sign. That's how many kids play high school football that are seniors. And so we did the math. I'm a very analytical person, but there's a time I'm just, you know, just thinking and I just thought about, well, I just got to reassess my body, my ability, or what's my goal. So the guy that was in front of me was an All-American high school out of a recruiting class. He was a defense player of the year in the state of Texas. And so I was like, man, he's going to be here for the next 3 years at least. And then he'll go to the pros, and then I will have a chance my senior year. So I'll contribute as a redshirt freshman, sophomore, junior, then maybe my senior year, I have a chance to start for the wrecking crew. That was my hope and goal. So I rescheduled my priorities. 6 o'clock in the morning, I made myself go work out because I knew I had to lose weight. Go to class at 8 because I have to go to school. Came back at lunchtime and worked out again. Because whatever I need to work on, if it's jump rope, if it's stretching, whatever it was I could find that I was going to do, whether it's going to help me with my football ability. And then 4 o'clock, I came back with the team and worked out for the whole year. I did that for the whole year. And remember, I was 235 pounds or so my high school year. So I got down to about 207. So I lost 20 plus 28 pounds or so to give myself an opportunity. And I worked myself during that spring ball all the way up to be a backup to that guy, which my goal was to be his backup. And I was like, man, I'm excited. We're about to play LSU opening kickoff. It was a Wednesday, Saturday. We're about to play LSU. LSU had, you know, Anthony McFarland. You had Kenny Annis, Eddie Kinnison. You had Kevin Falk. So they had some good, they had some squad. You know, some good players on that team, some studs. And so that Wednesday practice, right after practice, R.C. Slocum said, guys, let's get in the line. We're going to run sprints. So we're running sprints, and all of a sudden, the guy that was in front of me steps in a sprinkler head. Can't play. Can't start. That was my opportunity.
Wow.
And that's how I started my career. And I knew after that game against LSU, I was able to play at that position and at that level. And I knew how hard I work for that opportunity, and I was going to relinquish it. I was going to let him beat me. So we split time the whole year, and then I started the whole season, and then we moved him next to me the following season. So Yeah, that's how my career started. That's how my football career started. If I went to UCLA or went to Michigan,
done.
I don't think I had that willpower like I did in the state of Texas or at A&M. It was easier for me to drive home and talk to my coach instead of being on the phone talking to a coach.
It's incredible how life happens.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's when I hear your story, I mean, you know, there was a whole generation of us that looked up to you and said, oh, you know, he just like got to where he got and just, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You glide through.
No.
Who knew? Who knew that that was your, you know, I mean.
Well, I was going to transfer. I was going to quit. I was, man, they used to call them. So Highway 6 runs right through College Station, A&M University to Houston and to Waco. Which is University of Baylor or Baylor University. And the coaches always said, if you ask them the questions about what was that win like his freshman year, he had the Highway 6 look, you know, he's gone, he's out of here. And there was a lot of us that didn't make it. And I think that reality really hit when RC also said on that meeting at the auditorium that first day, was that look to your right. And look to your left, one of those guys not going to be here in 3 years. And it was true because we had 25 guys, and I think there was 8 or 9 of us that was left in that class that senior year.
You know, as you know, American history in football, you know, kids all over the country, you know, in the Midwest dream from day one, you know, high school, elementary school of becoming somebody in the NFL or NBA or, you know, all these major league sort of at that level. You never dreamt of it. You never even thought about it. That was not an ambition that you had.
No, it's kind of funny because I didn't have any role models, man. The role models that I had was just, you know, I was just making up guys. I shoot basketball all day and I lower the rim and I was like, hey, I'm going to be Shaquille O'Neal. You know what I mean? You imitate those guys like those. But I never really had a role model. You watch guys as I got older to my junior and my senior year in college, you did more because you start reality start hitting. Like, oh shoot, you might have a chance to play in the National Football League. So now you start watching the Sam Mills, you know, the Mike Singletary, the Zach Thomas, the Dexter Copley, guys that are smaller, undersized. And how did they get there? You know, a lot of them, they all have speed. And not all of them are speed. The Sam Mills wasn't the fastest guy. Zach Thomas are the fastest. They just understand the game of football. And I think that's a thing that you watch and you learn. And you had to. You know, your athletic ability can only take you so far. But I was fortunate enough to learn the game, understand the game, and understand why, the big why of why the offense is doing what they do. You know, in anticipation of down and distance and situation in the game. All that stuff factors in as you only have a 4 second really reaction. You got to react quick because the play only lasts about 4 seconds each play.
Right.
So, but I think that's, I didn't really dreamed about going to National Football League or think about if we made it until my senior year.
Okay. Walk me through that. What happens? I mean, through those 4 years, do you at any time do you go, okay, well, let me aim for the NFL and let me see if I can get there.
Yeah, you know what? You like anybody, like anything you do, you dream, right? You have dreams and you all have to set goals and you reset your goals every year, which is what I did. I every year, my first year, I got under my belt, just had to stay healthy and make it through the season. Just don't give it a big play, right? Just don't give it a big play. Whatever you do, don't be the one to give it a big play. Because if you get a big play where I was at, I would lose that position. The guy would take over and they would say, hey, he's not gonna be able to play. The next year I was gonna just make one big play a game. 10 tackles and one big play. That was my goal. Just to make one big play, a tackle for loss, interception, whatever. So you set goals. And the second year, you do the same. You keep doing it consistently, then you add up, you're like, man, so consistently the game slows down and understanding the game formation. We had different coordinators or different coaches that comes in. I think I had Tommy Tuberville, Phil Bennett, Mike Hankwitz, and I had 4 coaches in 5 years at A&M. So I had 2 coordinators, 1 coordinator, 3 coordinators in defense. So we had some change. We had turnovers there. But I learned something from those guys, each of them. And I think that's one thing that was nice, was that I was willing to learn and was able to learn and able to pick up, even though a lot of people will be upset because, oh man, I don't know how, what the coach wants or what the coach needs, you know, but everybody's coached differently. And I think at the end of the day, it's still see ball, get ball, you know, you gotta figure out, okay, where's the ball? I just gotta go get the ball, where the ball's at, right? And how do I get there? And you know, if I have some big offensive defensive alignment in front of me, and if I need to get more angles, I guess what, I gotta be a little bit deeper and stuff like that, things. And I think watching other players and see other players, and I didn't realize this too, when I got to the National Football League, man, I didn't realize how important using your hands were, meaning every position, except the quarterback position. Quarterback, even you to throw the ball, but running back, you know what I mean? Your hands gripping the ball, tucking it in high and tight, stiff arm, receivers. Hey, how to get aims to get a release off of DB with the hands on the receiver to slow them down if it's a press coverage.
Right.
Offensive lineman, defensive lineman obviously has to use the hands. So you don't realize how important using the hands are. When you start, if you understand that, then you have a chance. Like at the young age, if you can learn to use your hand, disengage, engage and disengage as a defensive player, that's 90% of the battle. You know what I mean? Get on and off, knowing your position, get to position. If the ball is committed, guess what? You find the ball. If it's on your gap, go get it. If not, find a way to get there. It's kind of interesting how football is really taught. And so for me, I think a lot of my success is really good coaching that I had. And fortunately, I had to go through different coaches, but it allowed me to learn so much from those guys.
Yeah. It really sounds like, you know, not only do you have to have this physical side and motor skills to play, but you really have to have this intellectual side. And I want to ask you, do you see a lot of players that came equipped with the talent but didn't have the mind?
Oh yeah, it is. That's really, you know, there's a sign that says life is 10% of what happens, and 85 or 90% is how you react to it, right? It's just, that's like football. That's like, it's like everything's a reaction. But if you don't anticipate, or if you don't understand why they're doing it, you know what I mean? As talented as you can be, or a God-given ability, if you can't function, meaning that there's a lot of things to it too. Everybody's wired different. To make it to that level, you have to be wired a little bit differently than everybody else, some way, somehow, right?
What does that mean? Yeah, wired differently
mean, hey, there's no pain. You have no pain tolerance. You know, play with a broken wrist. You know, I mean, there's things that happen. That, like, I play with a game. Look, my fingers are broke, right? So this finger was like this. I think after a tackle, it was this way. So I pull it back. It's like, but it just, everybody has a story. It's like, you're wired differently because the way you work and the way your mind is, like, you always want to get better. You know what I mean? It's everybody's different though. Like, but we all have to be wired a little bit differently because it's not easy. Hey, just like, oh, I'm going to make it to national. You know, and it's very seldom you see a LeBron James. You know what I mean? A LeBron James is a guy that was high school, junior high. They know he was going to be a superstar. And he's still a superstar. Look at him. You know what I mean? But that's not all. That's not everybody. You know, Kevin Durant might be another one that you can say. Even a Kobe Bryant, a lot more easier than a basketball player than a football player. I think you could say, I might think one guy you say, hey, he's going to be in the National Football League. You know, I got to tell you who it is. It's Ndamukong Suh. I was like, yeah, it was in eighth grade or whatever he was. You knew he's going to be in the National Football League. The way he's built, the way he is, and how powerful he is. You know what I mean? It's only a few players that you can say, you know, Adrian Peterson might be the other person as a running back. When he was in eighth grade, high school, you knew he was going to be special. Mm-hmm. But overall, it's hard, man. It's like, you know, you never know. Look at my opportunity. Look at the path, how I got there.
Yeah.
You know, if that guy never steps on a sprinkler head, there's never been a dat win. Right?
Yeah.
It's like, there was never a dat win if there was no sprinkler head right there. And how the hell do you run into a sprinkler system? I don't know, but that's crazy.
It is. And maybe along the way to the NFL, there was the sprinkler head story for you, or how did you get to the NFL? Was there an accident, or maybe what happened?
Well, you know what, because I was fortunate to coach in the National Football League for 3 years with the Cowboys. So the process is not just, hey, it's overnight or it's 1 year. And I think it was because of the 4 years of work and the improvement day really and the consistent. I think that's how I got drafted. It's just because they said, hey, he's reliable. We know what he is. He might not be the fastest, might not be the biggest. We'll give him a chance. You know, I mean, I was graded as a fifth round draft pick because I can see the card, the number. Hey, it's a fifth round grade on me, but they drafted me in third round, which we're lucky because all those there's like 20 linebackers went before I did. I don't know if you remember that year in 1999. If you go back, I bet you there's like Barry Gardner. I can go back to name all of them. Like there's a lot of guys that were drafted before me, but which was fine. But I understand it's a business side too. I'm not 6'4", 250 pounds that plays that position because if you really think about how the NFL works, it's an investment. So if you draft a guy in the first round at 6'4", 250 pounds, if he doesn't play well in 2-3 years, you can still trade him for some draft pick, meaning 6th or 7th, not much, but something, right? If you get a 5'10", 230 pound player, you draft in the first round, doesn't pan out. It was supposed to pan out. Why would now they lose out, you see? Yeah. So yeah. That's why they do what they do. And that's why they rank him because they think even though he might not be the most athletic or most whatever, but when they draft those guys in the first round, they think, hey, that's no brainer. He's the best player. But they know the value. You know, you go down the list of players that were traded and that's why. Usually it's measurables are the big part. And for me, NFL was thinking and dreaming on draft day. But to hear your name called late in the evening, I think that back then the draft was first three rounds, 10 a.m. to like 8 p.m. or 8:30 p.m. I think 8 p.m. I got a phone call from Jerry Jones. And you know, we had some family members at the house. Mom was cooking and we got that phone call, man. It's like, you know, how does it feel to be a Dallas Cowboy? Wow. And for me, I was like, golly, finally. And unfortunately, amazing story. Come to America, you play for the America sport. Now you got a chance to play for America's team. I was lucky and fortunate. Not many players in the National Football League get a chance to play in the home state all three levels. And I got a chance to do that. So, yeah, it was athletic career-wise, it was a bit unbelievable ride. I couldn't ask for anything better. Learned a lot through it. You know, a lot of ups and downs. Wish we won more games with the Cowboys. But unfortunately, we didn't.
What was your first year like playing for the Cowboys?
You know, it's things were, I even tell you, the first week I got to so when you get drafted, the next week you have to go to mini camp. So we call that it was in Chan Gailey was a coach that had an option to have a mini camp, so he had a mini camp. You know, it's totally business. In college, it's more you still got to go to school, but you practice and you play games. But this is strictly business. And I can tell you, when I got to the Cowboys, the first I encountered with was Darren Woodson. Darren Woodson is a Ring of Honor, unbelievable All-Pro player for the Dallas Cowboys safety. I learned a lot from him in my 7 years with them. And my first day I met him, the first time I met Darren. Darren looked at me, go, "Hey, Dad, congratulations! You're a heck of a football player." But just make sure one thing, you won't be a former player longer than you'll be a player. I was like, I didn't resonate me early on as a rookie. Oh. You'll be a former player longer than you'll be a player. And in a couple of years or even that summer kind of resonated, or after that following year resonated a little bit more and realized, hey, man, this is an opportunity. It goes by fast and it'll end one day soon. So we still have the same work ethic and the same drive early on. But my first mini camp, I show up to mini camp and the Cowboys playbook was about that thick. A&M playbook was about that thick. So every situation, everything you can think of, it was in that playbook. And I didn't go through all of it. I just went through some. And as we were going through the 7-on-7s and during the 7-on-7, which is quarterbacks, receivers, tight ends, and running backs versus linebackers, defensive backs, which are corners and safeties. And we go call a play on offense and defense calls a play and you adjust and you react to what offense is trying to do. Halfway through 7-on-7, I get a name call, Dad. And I was like, God, they didn't sound my name. So I looked over, it's the defensive coordinator, Dave Campbell. And he said, yeah, get in there. So I was like, oh, shoot, you know, I played 51 games at A&M. I'm freaking All-American. I was like, I know what I'm doing. So I run in, and I got the signal from Coach Campbell. So my back is turned to you guys, right? So you're the offense, I'm the defense. I got a signal, call, broke the huddle. And I look back. Freaking A, it was Troy Aikman. I look behind him. It was Emmitt Smith.
Wow.
I look to my right. It was Michael Irvin. They snapped the ball. I didn't even move. I was like, these guys, man, the triplets are on the field, man. This is crazy.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, it's all legend.
That was my first encounter with mini camp. But, man, that was such at all. You're talking about starstruck, man. You're talking about, are you kidding me? I'm on the freaking field with these three guys. And, you know, on top of that, we had all the ones. We had prime time. We had – you know, Kevin Smith, you know, Leon Lett. We had you go down the list, man, of all the great players or Super Bowl players from the 96 team, and that was still there.
How much time do you get to spend with all those guys?
It's a little bit different. We during our time, it's really like college. You had to go to the dorm. You had to go eat at the cane. You know what I mean? Yeah. You had to go, and you're on your schedule with the team schedule where – it's a little bit more different because some of those guys are older. I was 22 years old or so, got into the league. And some guys are 30, 34, have family, you know what I mean? They have their own life. And for us, we're like, oh, okay, single guys, you know what I mean? We hang out, you know what I mean? Whatever it is. So you don't get to spend a lot of time with them. And a lot of guys like myself, I didn't really do much outside, meaning that I didn't party as a lot. You know, I went out and did some stuff, but I didn't really party a lot. So I was so focused. And I think that was the reason that Darren was talking about. Like, man, you got all these guys that goes out, do stuff. And guess what? Hey, priorities are not right, man. You ain't gonna last long in this league. And so that's the hardest part, I think, to have a team. Oh, even though you show up to work every morning and you're there, you practice, and you know, the whistle blows, and after you watch a little film with them at the end, they go home, they depart, you go home and yeah, next day to go to work again. So it's just like a work.
Yeah, but, just showing up to
work. Yeah, so just... the time it's fun, it's a locker room where it does get more relaxing and you travel with the team and be able to go eat somewhere before the meeting starts. And I think that's what the best part that we miss for me was we always had a group of about 10, 12, 15 guys, which is a lot for 44, 50 guys that travels every game. So every away game we used to travel and we'll find a restaurant. And for example, if we go to Philadelphia, it's going to be Geno's, it's going to be Pat, you know what I mean? It's going to be Philly cheesesteaks, you know what I mean? It's like, hey, so we'll take a group of guys and we'll drive down the street in the car, it's a cab back then, and we'll figure out who wants to eat what, and we'll hang out. And that's the time we hang out before a meeting starts and get focused again. When we go back to the meetings and we start watching film, that's when, you know, you got to turn that switch. Now the mindset kind of, hey, this is a business trip. But, you know, we go to New England, we get the clam chowder, we go to, you know, barbecue place in Kansas City. The best place, I was telling somebody the other day, the best food though, from all my years of traveling all around the country, all these great city, all these places known for food, was in LA. And Larry Allen from Sonoma State, Hall of Famer Larry Allen, he grew up there in South Central. So we go play the Raiders and San Francisco, the 49ers. So every time we play those teams on the West Coast, on the bus on the way after the game, Larry's family will have his trays of just barbecue, ribs, brisket. Oh, man. He was just back in the bus. We just sit down and just eat a couple of those. But those are the best. Like stuff like that was phenomenal.
You talk about God and the religious experience for your life a lot. When did that like become strong in your life?
Yeah, you know what's crazy? Growing up Catholic, it becomes a, you know, scheduled, right? You wake up, you do the rosary, mom. If you're up early enough, you jump in and do some rosary with her. You go mass daily if you can. Weekend for sure, and Sundays. If you go Saturday night, you might be able to get a pass on Sunday if you got something going on. And but really, my faith really hit me with all I went through in 1999, went to A&M. I was just got done and got drafted by the Cowboys. My high school workshop teacher, Bill Bailey, moved to Dallas a year before, which is my, I was a senior at A&M, and became a school teacher in Dallas. And he was a chaplain, and he's going to ministry school up in Dallas. I think Dallas, Theology School of Dallas. So right before we went to training camp, I go, hey, Mr. Bailey, I just got this apartment. I need to borrow your truck. I didn't have a truck. I need to borrow your truck to pull this U-Haul to go get my TV, couch, and bed. It's only three things I had in college. And he goes, I'll go with you. So we went to go rent a U-Haul. And for 3 hours down from Dallas to College Station, we talked about Jesus. And 3 hours back, we talked about Jesus. And that's when I accepted Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior. And I knew I was missing something. You know what I mean? I was like, why did God chose me? You know, I mean, you think about hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese boys, maybe millions of Vietnamese boys that came over from Vietnam during the war. Why did God choose me? Why did he give me the opportunity to play for A&M, to play for the Dallas Cowboys? And I think that's, it hit me then, and I didn't know. I just knew I accepted Jesus Christ. I know I'm going to live my life through Jesus. But I didn't know the purpose of it. And as you grow older, the last 22 years now that I accepted Jesus as my Lord and Savior. And every year, July 2nd of 1999, since then, July 2nd, I call and I text Mr. Bailey or Coach Bailey every time and I tell him, thank you. You know what I mean? And for me, it's just a purpose now. It's that how do I can help others to find Jesus? And I know it's hard and it's tough and it's a challenge. And am I an influencer today? Am I an influencer today to Jesus, to these kids that I interact with? You know, 75% of my employees are student, high school students. And what are they, which path are they taking? And I know my leadership crew, they all believe in Jesus. And we try to trickle that down to get them. And we do quite a bit with Fellowship of Christian Athletes. And we do stuff. And for me, that's how I accepted Jesus. And now I practice and I realize that I'm not perfect. There's only one perfect person. It was him. And for me, it's, you know, my kids and my family and also my employees is how do I give them to know Jesus and to accept Jesus and know that, hey, it's not always going to be easy.
Can I ask you, okay, so in 1999 with Mr. Bailey talking about Jesus Christ, but you're Catholic, right? And so to accept Jesus in the way that you're talking about, mm-hmm. is a departure from how we grew up as Catholics, right? I
exactly. And you know what? My mom finally accepted it. I went down 99. So I still was a Catholic. I married my wife in a Catholic church. I still went through it as a Catholic. But I think as I went on, I will tell you when we, 2015, 16, my daughter was, probably she was what? She was, I can't do math, 10, 13. She was 13 or 14 years old, 13. And what's crazy, we went to a Catholic church. And I'm not saying anything about the Catholic. I love the Catholic church. I love the tradition. I love the culture. I love what it represents. And I felt like my kids wasn't getting the whole, we would lose them in the church because you do the rosary, you sit down and there's a sermon and they do the first reading of the Old Testament and do the second reading of the New Testament. And then they talk about the sermon. And during that time, the priest doesn't really elaborate on the why, you know what I mean? Why they correlate the New and the Old Testament together. So I felt like they're like, there's in the ceiling, da, 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 distracted. And I saw my nieces and nephews were the same. And I was like, God, there's something. So my wife and I talked about it. I said, hey, let's try some different church. So we went to a Southern Baptist church and, you know, with music. So we listened to Christian music all the time. And well, it kind of hit home. And I bet you in the last 6 years or so, five years, that we really became more of a Bible-centered life. That has changed our life. You know what I mean? We talk about Bible. My kids who are, I got two boys that are 6 years old, and they can reverse some, you know what I mean, some Bible verses. And which should I wish, you know, we did this with my kids younger, and when they were younger, but it is what it is. And they know how important Jesus is. And they finish my sentence about anything I talk about Jesus. And I think that's not sending away from the Catholic. I love the Catholic faith and what they believe in. And a lot of my family, my mom still practices Catholic. So she still do her deal. That's all she, you know, I mean, that's what she knows.
But how did she react to you becoming Baptist?
Well, I didn't really, I think it's just understand that as long as we have Jesus. And I keep telling her, I was like, at the end of the day, it's Jesus. You know, the religion is started by human. You know what I mean? It's not where, you know, at the end of the day, yes, it's Jesus Christ, but you know, you have Lutherans, you have, because my wife was Lutheran, she converted to Catholic. And then also now we're Baptist, where, you know, we're Bible-based more than anything. You know, I say our Baptist because it's Southern Baptist. We talk about the Bible and we dissect the Bible. And I think that's what's very entertaining to me. And I get more out of it because, you know, David Jeremiah is one of the guys I listen to. He's out in South Carolina, in San Diego. He's in San Diego and a Turning Point out there. And he does an unbelievable job of explaining the Bible. And I think that's what's, it makes you more stay hungry, I guess. Where the Catholic faith for me, it felt like it's really routine. And this is what you do. Very routine. Yeah. And I felt like, yeah, the growth is very small, but your faith grows, obviously, the relationship and how you pray and you meditate. That's huge in the Catholic faith, where here it's more of a conversation with your Lord and Savior.
Yeah. You know, when I look out into the landscape of the U.S., it's very, you know, a lot of people are faith-based in the Midwest, and then out in the coast, like where I live, you know, there's no real talk of any religion, you know. I grew up a Catholic, but, mm-hmm. you know, in my life, it's very secular, and it's very, you know, that's just the way it is out here in the coast. It's like two different countries, mm-hmm. almost, you know. Yeah. Do you find that to be a sad thing for you? Do you find
I think it's sad everywhere. Even now, like you think about even the kids, like some of these kids don't even know, and they don't want to know, and they have an excuse for it, or you know, people. I don't know what it is. I feel like that the religion or having faith in Jesus, it's not because if it wasn't for God and Jesus, and I wouldn't be here. You know what I'm talking about? Like, my mom was on a boat. She could have passed away, you know, having a miscarriage. She was pregnant. You know, we were out there in the sea, leaving the country, being so stranded out there in the ocean for a few days. But I think it's sad because nowadays that the social media takes so much away from these kids and what to believe. And what is it? Is it, is it me getting all the likes? What I post makes me more acceptance? And I think that we get a false kind of security and athletes, even athletes, like for myself, like, you know, I was going through a deal and there was a guy named Joe Edelman from DC. He spoke at one of our chapel during our time with the Cowboys. And he said that, you know, why does a athlete is put on a pedestal? Why is that? Oh, no, you know, the masculinity of a guy is because, oh, he can play athlete. He's, you know, whatever it is, it's that you can't. It's just it would be there. But guess what? Like what we talked about before, it's that eventually it'll fade away and he will not. You know what I mean? It's almost like expectations. You know, certain expectations that you have. Guess what? Most likely, you'll be disappointed with your expectations. You know what I mean? And if you don't have Jesus, you don't have Christ in your life, now you understand that, hey, that's part of it, and they have a plan. You know, everything, there's always a plan for things that happen. You know, if it's selfishly, unselfishly, whatever it is, it's always going to be difficult if you don't have something else. If you think it's all about you and, hey, I did it myself and I'm better than you, and You know what I mean? Comparison is a thief of joy, and that's the hardest part. And I think we live in the world that's what's going on. It's that, hey, sports and stuff like that, where shoot, you go to Sunday and freaking, hey, there's more people outside playing sports on the way to church than ever. You know what I mean? It's like, are they going to church at all? They're just going to worry about being the next Pele or the next LeBron. I don't know. You know what I mean? It's just like sports have taken over, or not just sport, but
entertainment and all that.
Anything. Yeah. So really, really churches and community of Christ, I think, has really been on the second, on the stovetop, I guess, moved to the side. Mm-hmm. It's not as important as it used to be. We grew up, guess what? Shoot. Hey, Sunday, you're going to church, we're going to Catholic or wherever.
But how did you never rebel against, you know, that way of life growing up?
Why did never?
Yeah. Well,
it's kind of hard when you walk in the middle of the night, and your mom's kneeling down crying. You know what I mean? And you witness that she's worried to death about you, and all she has is hope in Jesus. You know, she's doing her rosary. And now every day I tell you, when I used to travel and in high school, we used to play away games. She didn't go to the away games, obviously. But I used to get home at midnight, 1 o'clock. I walk in the door, and guess who's awake? She is, and guess what she's doing? She's on her knees praying. And I think that's why I never
abandoned
and rebellious about anything, because I knew, shoot, hey, that was her deal. That's the only thing she can hold on to.
Wow.
And I think that's what we do now. That's what I can hold on to, is I know, hey, this Bible and Jesus Christ and the Word of God.
What was the amount of time that you played for the Cowboys, and what was the sort of the end? What was that like?
So I played 7 years, seven seasons with the Cowboys, and you know, it went by fast, man. I don't realize how fast it went by. You really think back about it. I thought I was going to play it. So I was going into my seventh season, the best I ever felt. I was like, golly, I can play another three. And I think if you ask any player in the National Football League that has played 2, 3, 4 years, what's their goal? 99% would say, hey, double digit. I want to make it to 10. That's everybody's goal, to make it 10 years. And after that offseason, I was like, golly, I felt good. And then right at minicamp, our last minicamp before we left to go home for the summer break, which we have about 3 weeks or so summer break before training camp starts. And I got hit right in the knee. And I had I had to go get my knee scope because I had a meniscus tear. And I think I made a big mistake in that 3 weeks. Right after that practice, I had a meniscus surgery, and then I worked my house too fast. I came back too fast, and I wasn't quite the same. And it just hit home, man. It's like, wow. I was like, dude, I can see the play, but I can't get there.
Wow.
All of a sudden, we were flying back home. I was sitting with Dan Campbell and Dexter Coakley, and I told Dan. Dexter was on my left side on the aisle, and then Dan was inside because we had a seat in between. And Dan is now the head coach of the Detroit Lions. And he and I sat there, and I told him, Dan, I don't think I can play anymore, man. I was like, I can see the plays. I know exactly what it is. My last game was it wasn't my last game, but my birthday, on my 30th birthday, we played San Francisco out in San Francisco. And I got the interception to win the game. Coach Parcells did not want to fly back to Texas because we're going to play the Raiders the following week. So we stayed in a hotel, and that was the worst week of my life. I had a stinger, and then I had that knee issue. And my knee was hurting so bad. So bad. And as an athlete, you will know, hey, you got to hydrate, right? You got to drink all the time, you know, during football season, especially gallons and gallons of water in your body. And I can tell you that in the middle of the night, I had to go to the restroom, but I was in so much pain, I would not get up to walk to the restroom. Wow. I would hold it all the way to the morning. And I knew during practice that week, leading up to the Raiders game, had multiple stingers on my neck, and it wasn't fun. I lost the fun, and I lost the edge. And in that 1 week, I knew I was done. And I called my wife and I told her, I think this is it, man. I don't know if I can go through it anymore because I was suffering so much. Like it wasn't even fun for me. You know, I love the game. I love practice. And you can tell any coach, you can ask any of my coaches and how I enjoy competition. But when you knew how hard I have to work during the offseason to get the edge, and now I got to go back and really reevaluate. And I didn't even make it through my last season, the seventh season. I think I only played till Thanksgiving, which I lost about the last month of the season. So I missed about 4 or 5 games there at the end of the year. So, but, you know.
Yeah. I think they say the average is 4 years, right, in the NFL?
Yeah, 3.5.
Well, and
beating.
Say it again?
You take a beating.
Yeah. How's your body now?
My body's good. You know, my knees, obviously, I don't do any physical exercise. I just don't eat as much, and I play golf when I can. I swim once in a while. I jump in the pool about every other day or so, just to about 5-10 minutes just to loosen up before in the morning. Just a little routine that I do just to put my mind off certain things. But my body feels good. Some days are better than others, obviously, but it's just part of it. Yes, any football players that played a length of time. And I think it's just a build up too from playing so many games in college.
Yeah.
And then we got to National Football League with Bill Parcells, his old school ways of coaching. I think he took about 5 years of my career from me. You know, we used to do all these drills, man. And we're talking about Larry Allen and how good he was and how physical a specimen he was. And shit, we had to do a drill that we call 5 across, meaning that we're 5 yards across and he'll blow a whistle and Larry and I will go at it. And it's like, dude, this is freaking, I'm hitting brick walls, what I'm doing. And just see it, but it's just building toughness to see how tough you are. And if he can trust you in the trenches and see if he can, is able to compete. And you know what's crazy? That was my third year with Bill. Yeah, my fourth year with Bill. And we still had to do those drills. And I was like, yeah, you know, when you play that long with somebody and obviously you're an undersized player, you would think he'll give you a pass. But there's no such thing as Bill Parcells' pass.
Now, there's nobody right now, Vietnamese kids, that's on their path, right, to the NFL or anything?
Not that I know of. There was a kid out of Denton, Texas, that played high school football, but I don't know if he ended up playing in college at all. But, you know, when all this stuff was going on when I was in college and when I was having some success in college late in my career, I thought it would open some gates and some barriers for some of these kids. Just go, hey, man, go out there and play. And yeah, you know, my nephews and them try to play. But I think at the end of the day, it's just, I don't know, I guess you have to be wired a little bit differently, I guess. So I don't know. That's a little bit disappointing. I wish there was other Vietnamese American or even other Asian American pursuing the game of football, because you know the game of football has taught me so much in life, life skills. Hard work, commitment, dedication, balance, scheduling. You know, it's the rewards of it, also the celebrations. So at the end of the day, you know, it taught us so much. I wish there was more kids out there of Asian descent.
Yeah. What did you do after you got out?
So I've been doing quite a bit of different things. Now I coached with the Cowboys for about 3 years. And then I decided to go down to A&M for a couple of years to coach college school there. And we don't say alumni. That's why I was going to say I'm a former student. So but went out there for a couple of years. Thought I was going to finish my career coaching, but unfortunately, it didn't happen that way. A little bit disappointed what happened with all the stuff that was going on that came down there in Aglin when I was there coaching. But then I left to do – I did ESPN radio for a couple of years. And then now I'm doing, I've been for the last 5 years, almost 6 years now, I've been working, I run a Chick-fil-A store here in Dallas, Fort Worth, really the Fort Worth area.
Can you get into the, what you were talking about? It was an unfortunate experience at
A&M. Yeah. You know, when you are a former player and you go back to your school and you assume that, you know, coaches coach and you allow them to coach. He, you know, Mike Sherman did a phenomenal job, in my opinion, as a head coach of the Texas A&M football team during his tenure there. And I was fortunate to be with him for 2 years to see the transformation of young men that he developed. Guys like the Ryan Tannehill, the Jake Matthews, who are still in the National Football, Von Miller. You know, I mean, stories that nobody knows that, you know, Von Miller was sitting home his sophomore year. He was kicked off the team, decided to quit, drive home back to Dallas. And we got home. His dad said, hey, you got no place to sleep, man. You better drive your butt back to College Station. You ain't gonna sleep in the house. So he drove back and they got suspended. That's the offseason or that spring game. And then comes back and, you know, look at his career. It changed him. If you ask Von Miller today, what changed him in College Station? He'll tell you Mike Sherman is the most influential person in his life. And that woke up call is where he at today as a human being, as a person. He's a great kid, great Christian person, obviously believe in Jesus, but you know, I mean, he wouldn't be the athlete he is or the player he is today if he didn't have Mike Sherman. So stuff like that, there's stories, hundreds and hundreds of stories I can tell you. You know, we didn't win enough games, obviously. That year, I think we lost 5 games by a total of 12, 13 points or something like that. And we didn't know Johnny Manziel. We had Johnny Manziel on the team, but we didn't know how great he was going to be as a player. But that's the year before Johnny kind of got on, exploded on the scene of college football. But so just because there was a little bit more decision-making outside of the coaching staff that I was really disappointed. Knowing that, hey, no one's safe. Even, you know, for a player that came out of the university, a player that was part of the university and want to be part of the university and trying to impact young men to become boys to become men. Unfortunately, it didn't happen that way. So it was kind of sad for me because I thought I was going to be. I moved my family down there and left. I left Cowboys to go down there. And I thought that was going to be a place where, you know, for the next 20, 30 years, I was going to spend my time because how much I love A&M football and A&M. And unfortunately, it didn't go the way that we were like. But you know what? Everything happens for a reason. I have no grudge against A&M or anything like that. It's just that through the experience of the last few years with ESPN, with here, Chick-fil-A, I couldn't ask for anything better. And I wouldn't ask for it. I learned so much through those times at A&M. And so,
you know, just hearing your story about that, it reminds me of there's, you know, you're a minority. You're a Vietnamese person with a lot of white guys, right? This is the way. That's the world that you came up in the last 25 years. Or how much did you have to deal with? I mean, or was it because you're talented, you work hard, you don't have to deal with the politics of the racial politics side?
Yeah, you know, I think you have to face it regardless. I don't think some are worse than others, but I don't know. I think always been taught earlier, like I told you earlier, sometimes, you know, going through what we went through in 75, coming to America, living in Rockport and the tension that was going on. I think you put your nose down and you just grind. You know what I mean? You just block everything out. You block all the noise. And we can, you know, it's cliche what we say is just, hey, control what you can control. But really, that's really how I live. I was like, man, I don't worry about the noise outside. I don't worry about, you know, I got my family. I got things that I do. I got some friends and I got a business that I run. I'm going to be a good steward of what's entrusted me here with Chick-fil-A. And I think that's what, you know, when you have kids and you have things that goes on, it's hard to worry about other stuff that you can't control. And I think that's the biggest thing about people that's going on now. I was like, man, you worry too much about other stuff. Like, dog, why? You know, me, everybody has problems. Everybody has issues. You know, if you worry too much about that, you're not even knowing what's going on with your own life. And when you're surrounded, and one of my saying that I have at the store is be where your feet is at. You know what I mean? Be at the moment, be the presence. You know what I mean? You got things outside this building. When you come in this building, hey, look down. This is where you at.
It's good advice. It's so really good advice.
Yeah. So just be at the present and be at the moment.
Have you been to Vietnam? You've been back?
I went to Vietnam one time when I retired from the Cowboys. I went back in 2006 with a business partner and you know, we went back to Hanoi, which I couldn't tell my parents, you know, because they will be, you know, staying up all night praying the whole time. But I was only there for a week. I didn't stay long, but God, what a beautiful country. Went back there and the food was phenomenal. We went back there for a business opportunity and after reevaluating it, we thought it was not a good idea. So we didn't pursue it, which you know, I don't know what they're doing now. It's Hoa Long. We went down to Hanoi and then we went to Ha Long Bay, the seventh wonder of the world. And they want to build all the casinos and hotels. So I don't know if they even pursued that. I don't know if they did that or not, but that was a presentation that the prime minister had at the event that we went to. But
you going back, you plan to go back anytime soon?
I don't know. I would like to take my wife there soon. You know, I still got the 6-year-old kid, so it's a little bit tougher. But yeah. You know, maybe, I guess maybe when my daughter graduates from college, then the boys would be 10 years old, which is a lot easier. So hopefully 4 years, if I do that 4 years from now. But my wife loves this travel, so I need to take her so she'll have a chance to see what Vietnam is all about.
Dad, you've been an inspiration to many of us. I remember being in the Marine Corps, and there were guys that were huge fans of yours, guys that loved the Dallas Cowboys. And, you know, it was a privilege and an honor to sit here with you today and listen to your story. And I really appreciate the time. And I know you're really busy, but thank you for taking the time to spend with me.
Okay, you're welcome, Kenneth. Anytime, man. It was good. Have fun.
Thank you so much. And have a wonderful day, and hope to talk to you soon.
All right, man. Take care. Got my number, man. Anything, let me know.
Thank you. Sure will. Thanks, Dad.
Okay, bye-bye.
Right, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran and Javier Proenza. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts. Thanks again for listening.